they used to be. And this is a spiritual war. There's no question that we're going to face that face on. We're not going to be able to pretend it's not a spiritual war anymore. We're now in a new... I have a couple of chapters in the book about Islam. And, you know, most Christians have not cared about or paid any attention to Islam. But we better start understanding the kind of war we're fighting, because this is the one that's going to be right in our face.
Now, the hard part about understanding that battle is that you have a phenomenon coming largely from the new civ called political correctness.
You got that right.
If you're looking at things with a didactic viewpoint, political correctness is a mental morphine. It prevents you from seeing or saying clearly what is going on. And that's the hard part that you have right now. The second issue will, of course, be that I tend to think the new civ, as all new civs of this nature, always come with the seeds of their own destruction. And socialism has shown that it has no lack of penchant for self-destructing. The problem is what happens between the time it comes into ascendancy and the time that it finally self-destructs, largely from economic and social pressures, when people just get sick of it. So that's quite a bit of time. For the Soviet Union, it was 70 years. Europe is still in love with socialism, even though it's failing it as they watch.
You're much more optimistic than I am. I mean, you think that it will... I don't know if that's optimistic, actually, because 70 years, that's like two or three generations. So that's pretty tough. You know, you change everything.
Pretty tough, yeah. And then look how long it's taken them to rebound. And then other people go, oh, well, let's see, it was better in the good old days under Marxism. Because by that time, people have forgotten. Now, in the middle of that, there is opportunity for evangelism, because people are truly lost. As these times move forward, the sense of despair and hopelessness, which was Marxism in its earlier manifestations in the Soviet Union, really begins to affect the average populace. You look at the alcoholism rate and life expectancy and other related issues. And one of the things that happens early on, though, however, during these times, is that the new paradigm says, aha, we've finally gotten here. We need to eliminate the old paradigm. And by eliminate, they mean by whatever means possible. It takes them a while to get there, but they invariably do. And so those are the times that I think you're looking at as things move down. You're right about the war on Islam, because I've been asking for several weeks here on the show, tell me who the real enemy is in the war on terror. Well, it's a fanatic fundamentalist whatever that doesn't represent the true Islam. Well, how do we know these fanatics? Will they take the Quran literally? Oh, well, that's interesting. You mean sort of like the Christians take the Bible as the word of God in the same way. Now, if we can do certain things to the Muslims in the name of fighting this war, gee, what keeps us from doing that to the Christians later on when the mood of society shifts in that area?
This is a very problematic issue. I'm telling you, I don't know the answer to that, and it worries me terribly.
You can see what I mean. It's a double-edged bite. It's not either or.
No, you're right.
And either time you try to address either side of the issue, you run afoul of somebody in some political correctness area. And once it goes down the political correctness toilet, real conversation stops at that point.
You're so incisive. You get right to the core of these difficult issues. You know, the reason I wrote the book is just so we can have some kind of platform so that we can look at things realistically, to put things in perspective. And that is one issue that I think that if people read my book, it would be less difficult for them to grapple with that issue. But that is a difficult issue. What we have to do, I say in the book, and I say in personal conversation all the time, is grow up, become mature people. In general, what Americans have thought of as their birthright is to remain children intellectually and emotionally. And what I mean by that is, when you're a child, you have an extreme of emotions. You love and you hate. You're mad and you're sad. That's what an infant. The part of the maturation process is to learn that there are emotions in between, that there are shades of gray. And what we have is, in our current dilemma, we've been so rich and so privileged in this country to live comfortable lives, and basically we don't have highway robbers or bandits. You know, we can travel, we can do what we want. I mean, terrorism strikes us as absolutely obscene, but throughout human history, to leave your native land, you expected to be absconded with or waylaid because there were bandits abroad in the world. Well, we've cleaned all that up, and we feel so so comfortable, and we have plenty of money and air conditioning and all this. So we think of spirituality the same way. This is a shame, but it's true. Luxury breeds contentment and complacency. So what we have to face is that it has made us into spiritual and emotional children. This is rude, I understand. People don't like to hear that. But if you look at it closely, if the difference between an infant and an adult is the ability to see complexity and shades of gray, then this is what we have to re-access. We have to get that back, that skill. That we have to. In the old days, Christianity was full of subtle thought. But look at the average sermon today, the average tract. It's not very subtle, not very complex. I don't mean to, you know, beat up on my own people. You know,
do me a favor. Beat up on your own people. Because I've been saying some of the same things when I talked to our pastor recently, and whenever he's gone on a trip, the church attendance falls to a third of what it is because we have this little cult following type of thing. And I called him one day. I said, you know, you've got to stop announcing when you're not going to be there next Sunday. Because I said, it's an insult to the good speakers that you bring in to only find a fragmented church. I said, the second thing that bothers me about this is the level of immaturity displayed in that. And I began to think about this all the way through. But the third thing I will say is, if the church is to do what you are talking about, then they've got to go back and take a page out of Francis Schaeffer. You cannot keep putting your children in the Hitler Youth and expect them not to come out Nazis.
You're so right.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening. I'm your host tonight. My name is Michael Shaw for the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. It's great to be back here in the studio. I haven't been here since June, and I'm especially excited about our show tonight. We're going to talk about trade. You know, trade policy is what drives the world and has created empires and destroyed empires. It's allowed for free nations, and it's allowed for controlled nations. And America has been in the midst of massively shifting our historic trade policies into a new paradigm of trade policy. Both our hours tonight, we're going to talk about trade. We're going to talk about trade policies in the United States. And in the second hour, we're going to talk about trade policies in England. We're going to look at the comparisons between the trade policies and how they affect immigration and how they affect regionalization and really the political undoing of systems of government that have existed in England for 900 years and have been built in toward an advance of the human civilization and human condition, and then, of course, here in America for the last 225 years. The greatest achievement of mankind in all time, the application and declaration of independence with the principles that it rested upon. And here today, trade policies swarming the earth and coming straight out of Washington, D.C. and London are undoing all of that great effort in a very insidious way that is going to leave America, has begun to leave America, confused and distraught. And those circumstances are bound only to get worse if we don't come to understand the effect of trade policies and, in fact, what our trade policies are. So tonight, in our first hour, Doctor of Philosophy Stephen Yates is going to inform us as to the real effect and purpose of global trade agreements, including the recently enacted Central America Free Trade Agreement, otherwise known as CAFTA. Dr. Yates will explain how these phony free trade agreements are designed to undermine national sovereignty, establish regionalism, and feed the global governance monster while destroying the vision of the American experience. And Dr. Yates is a PhD and is probably the most published professional philosopher in South Carolina. He teaches, and in his words, is a lowly adjunct instructor of philosophy at the University of South Carolina. The reason he describes himself that way is he says that it's an occupational punishment for his utter lack of political correctness. Now, he's the author of Civil Wrongs, What Went Wrong with Affirmative Action, and a new book that's just out, as I understand it, this week, called Worldviews, Christian Theism versus Modern Materialism. His articles and reviews have appeared on lewrockwell.com, as well as News with Views and other websites. He's published in academic journals, including Inquiry, Meta Philosophy, American Catholic Philosophical Quarterly, Reason Papers, Public Affairs Quarterly, Journal of Libertarian Studies, Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and others. He's been a fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and recently he spoke on the Real Matrix and Sustainable Development at the 6th Annual Freedom 21 Conference in Reno, Nevada. He comes to us from Greenville, North Carolina, and it is my pleasure to welcome to the audience Dr. Steve Yates. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am here, and I want to thank you for having me back on your show. It's good to be back.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and I'm really excited about talking with you on this subject. I know that just this month you had a very important and detailed essay printed at News with Views that describes what it is we're going to talk about tonight in some detail, how it is that America is being sold out with policies like the Central America Free Trade Agreement. We'll be right back here at Freedom 21. We're back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates. And, Stephen, where do we start with this whole issue of trade policy and so-called free trade agreements, etc.?
Well, there's either of two places we could start. I could work under the assumption that everybody listening knows what CAFTA is, what it stands for. It stands for the Central American Free Trade Agreement. But because of that phrase, free trade, that's in there, there's a temptation there. It kind of puts people's brains to sleep because, to most economists anyway, free trade is supposed to be a good thing. And I think that's why a lot of mainstream economists backed CAFTA without really taking a close look at it.
Well, maybe then we need to start with what free trade really is and why free trade is good, and then look at these agreements and determine if, in fact, they represent ideas of free trade.
Okay. Suppose I've identified a need and I've produced an economic good or service that sets out to satisfy that need, that people want it and they're willing to pay for it. And for our purposes, it could there's any number of things it could be. Suppose you want to trade with me. Suppose we agree on a reasonable price. Reasonable here is what you're willing to pay me. And as opposed to what I'm going to want for compensation. But suppose we agree on this. I offer the good, you offer me money and compensation for it. In other words, we trade. Each of us goes away satisfied.
Well, each of us presumably are benefiting, so we're talking about a circumstance of mutual benefit. And
correct.
Clearly, if we were to multiply that by the millions of transactions that people engage in every day, all to mutual benefit, working toward mutual benefit, there's a great rise to society's benefit as a result of that cumulative event.
Sure, that's the economy of, or economics of free enterprise on a large scale. But the point is, there's no coercion on either side. I produced the good or the service through my ingenuity. I identified the need. I undertook
the specific actions necessary. You saw the good or as something of value to you, as something that would benefit you, and we traded. That, my friends, is free trade.
Well, we're going to have our audience from other stations returning with us here shortly. So hold with us for just a minute. We'll be right back. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show and discussing with Stephen Yates the concept of free trade. And as he explains it, it's working toward mutual benefit by trading things between ourselves, all working toward a rise in society generally, all based upon free enterprise and non-coercive interaction and exchange between people. This is the idea of free trade, and of course, if we're trading past national borders, we get into the issue of a nation's trade policy.
Yeah.
And explain to the listeners why it is that protectionism can be harmful, that those things that preclude free trade on a extra national basis can be harmful to the residents of the nation that actually deploys protectionist policies.
Well, they can be harmful in the sense that if by imposing tariffs or other kinds of restrictions on trade, you just at a very basic level, you're preventing people from achieving benefits that they want, and they would come to resent this. So, as Bastiat puts it, that's a good way of saying this: that when goods cross borders, armies don't. So, there you are.
And, of course, that's all presuming that the trade that is crossing borders is determined by those who are trading and not by those who are managing the trade.
Yes, exactly. Now, if we take this conception of free trade that I cashed out, really the next thing to do is to set out to compare these trade agreements, these big, massive accords that we're dealing with now, with that definition and see if they qualify.
Now, they call themselves free trade.
They call themselves that, but really anybody can use a phrase. Now, part of my argument against CAFTA is that it does not qualify as a free trade agreement. It qualifies as a managed trade agreement. If we want free trade with Canada and Mexico, well, thinking of NAFTA just for a minute, because just the list of countries is shorter.
NAFTA is the North American
Free Trade Agreement. Sure. But if we want free trade between Canadians, Mexicans, and Americans, all we need to say is there shall be no governmental interference between open and free trade between Americans, Canadians, and Mexicans. NAFTA, on the other hand, was thousands of pages long.
And why does it take thousands of pages to say that people here and people there can trade without the interference of government?
Oh, because those thousands of pages were necessary to throw in all of the regulations, because NAFTA, again, is about managed trade. It's not really free trade. And CAFTA expands NAFTA. It's based on the same model that managed trade that NAFTA was based on.
Now, is it possible, in your view, to have free enterprise and managed trade at the same time?
Not really, because the one will push the other one out. You'll have kind of had Gresham's law of bad money pushes out good, or it's the equivalent of it. Bad trade pushes out good trade.
It's my understanding that these global free trade agreements have effects on more than simple trading dynamics. They tend to promote immigration policies or the blurring of boundaries by bringing people, giving them free access to cross the borders in order to implement the managed trade policies. And it tends also to have regionalizing aspects to its provisions. Is that true, where we get political regions that grow out of these free trade agreements?
Yes, I think you could argue that CAFTA, it's useful to focus on CAFTA just because it's the most recent, is about a lot of things that have nothing to do with trade, per se. All you need to do to recognize this is read CAFTA's own preamble, and it's online. Now, the very first thing, once it's listed, the parties that are the parties to the trade accord, all you have to do is read down the list of what CAFTA sets out to do. For example, the first one, strengthen the special bonds of friendship and cooperation among their nations and promote regional economic integration.
Well, now, what does that mean, perchance?
Well, special bonds of friendship and cooperation, it's kind of vague. It could mean any number of things. I think President Bush has described things like propping up these fledgling democracies and things like that. Now, unfortunately, nothing in our Constitution obligates our government to do that.
Well, what bothers me about that kind of language, we see this in the sustainable development nomenclature everywhere, is that fine and fuzzy words are used that have no meaning other than the meaning that somebody applies to them at a later period of time. So we've got now government officials vested with authority under CAFTA to do these nebulous pursuits that end up being defined any way that the center power chooses it to be utilized.
Well, certainly. Now, the various chapters in CAFTA illustrate this. They different chapters create different regional international bureaucracies or tribunals, to use the term that they frequently use. Now, we could turn our attention to looking at the same statement still. Those four words, promote regional economic integration.
Now, that's really a political statement. I mean, there's no way they can fuzz that as a purely trade dynamic.
Well, no, because it's just focusing on the economic. The idea of an unregulated economic situation just hasn't been on anybody's radar screen since the 1930s, and even before then. The whole Keynesian conception of the economy is of a government micromanaged economy, priming the pumps. They loved that phrase. So my point here, if you're going to, to promote regional economic integration, is going to necessarily lead to regional political integration as well. And that's why so many of us are seeing red flags on this about the New World Order, about regional government, and threats to American independence, U.S. sovereignty. Because CAFTA certainly does that. So did NAFTA. So did the World Trade Organization, but CAFTA is taking it to the next level, and the FTAA, the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is the next thing on the horizon, takes this thing really to the next level.
And that level is?
Western Hemispheric Government.
Western Hemispheric Government.
Because it talks about the regional integration, economic integration of not six nations, or seven, or eight, but 34. All of the Western Hemispheric nations, except for Cuba.
Well, and we certainly have to see a pattern for this. In our next hour, we're going to talk with Englander, Dr. David Abbott, about how the European Union, originally the European Common Market, a so-called economic arrangement for free trade, has evolved into the European Union, which is a total political amalgamation of all of Europe, sucking England in at the same time. And so they're ahead of us in this process, but we can see the same pattern of continental or hemispheric integration of all countries under common rules that come out through global governance organizations. And that, in effect, is what these trade agreements seem to be doing, because 1,200 pages per agreement covering all aspects of human life tend to bring us to that point quite clearly if one pauses to look. And of course, we're not reminded of this by any major media news source. We don't hear anything about these trade policies, and nations are made and broken, and empires are created through trade policy, and lives and lifestyles and standards of living and freedom and private property, and all of that are dependent upon the nature of the monetary policy, the trade policy, and the foreign policy of a country. And it seems to me that these three concepts of policy, as administered by our federal government, Democrat or Republican led, are all leading us to the same end, and that is the erasure of our borders and the changing of our laws to meet this centralized global order's demands.
Sure. Now, on got less expertise on the development of the European Union probably than your next guest, but my understanding is that the European Union was originally sold to Europeans. There was the same behind-the-scenes maneuvering, but it was sold out as a free trade zone. Now they've lost, the individual nations have lost their currency, and for all practical purposes, their sovereignty is gone. Some of them are like France is an example, or the Netherlands is another example, are trying to do some fast backpedaling, but it may be too late.
Well, I think Tony Blair is doing fast backpedaling as well, because you know what I think the globalists learned by their European experience is that people don't take to these trade agreements when they understand them. And that's starting to show itself in Europe. And if Europeans can figure out these trade programs don't make sense, there's no reason Americans shouldn't. But that's why the administration, Washington, D.C., and the controlled media are so quiet about the real nature of these trade agreements, which have no bearing on historical American values and perspectives, and in fact are going to destroy the ideals which we depend on for having a life that is our own. We're going to break here again in a few seconds for a couple minute break, and we'll be back with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates. Well, we're back here at Freedom 21. We're going to work through this commercial break while some of our radio stations are away from us. And as we do that, you know, the story sometimes from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio can sound ominous. And certainly the American people, and in fact humanity itself, has its back against the wall, against this massively organized and funded thrust for creating global governance. But it is not as bleak as it may seem at the moment, because many people, many organizations are sprouting up that are seeing the broader picture, focusing on specific issues, and an awakening is on the horizon. And we'll point out a couple of tools that are available to you and for use in your neighborhood, because the truth is something that can come out and is coming out. For instance, the DVD-ROM called Taking Liberty, Understanding the Wildlands Project, put together by Dr. Michael Kaufman, a prior guest on this show, and the Stewards of the Range, the organization headed by Wayne Hage, another person who's made a great contribution to this radio show. Those interviews are available in our archives at F21SC/radio, and you can hear these prior interviews. But this DVD-ROM shows how the Wildlands Project is moving across our ranches, has gone across our forests, is now chewing up our farms, is taking our rural residents and putting squeezes, regulatory squeezes on them. It's shutting down our rural communities and forcing people into the smart growth zones where privately financed, government-controlled housing is on rampant pace for development in this country. That's something that's a half-hour segment that shows the endangered species and critical habitat and all the techniques being used, conservation easements, etc. All of the techniques that are being used by our federal government and state government to swallow up our land and put it under the control of central forces and corporate governance, socialist corporate organizations like the Nature Conservancy. Also, boy, the standby guide called Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, a guide for public officials. That costs $2.50 a copy. It's less than that, bought in bulk. But you read this, a short booklet, and you'll understand sustainable development. You give it to your public officials, and they'll be held accountable for dealing with the terrible consequences that are coming to our country via sustainable development policies. And you can spread it to your friends and neighbors. It's just a tremendous tool. And then, of course, too, there's the America's Choice, a 6-hour DVD, 5 1-hour segments, plus some extra from distinguished speakers from around the country. Liberty or Sustainable Development, America's Choice, a DVD. You can order any of these items in many places, but including Freedom21SantaCruz.net. Go to our store online. And then finally, a new product from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, the 8-hour CD version of The War on Reason, conducted in June of this year with people like Dr. Karen Efron of the of EdWatch, and Dr. Edwin Vieira on central banking and the sustainable world order, and other great interviews. So check out the store at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz for these products and others, and get yourself informed, get your neighborhood informed. This is a global to local program, and we've got to strike back at the local level, because that's where it comes right at us. So we're going to return with our regular audience here in just a few seconds, and we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Stephen Yates. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates. And let's just pick up from before the break, Steve.
Okay, you mentioned sustainable development. It's worth noting, useful to note, that sustainable development and all that it's involved in that term is pulled right into CAFTA without even leaving the preamble. Well, let me just read this statement. One of the aims of CAFTA to implement this agreement in a manner consistent with environmental protection and conservation, promote sustainable development, and strengthen their cooperation on environmental matters. So there you are. Sustainable development, little case S, little case D, is kind of stuck there in the middle, where if you're not paying close attention, you might not see it. But of course, that phrase is pregnant with an enormous agenda. Well, Agenda 21 is pulled into this trade accord, which is obviously far more than a trade accord at this point.
And yet you still find, politicians who are in the know on this, I think, who always like to say, oh, Agenda 21, that's a conspiracy theory. And yet you go to the website, go to the web and put in Agenda 21 or Sustainable Development, and you'll end up at the UN page that is entitled Sustainable Development Agenda 21. And you then can go to any federal agency and you can find Sustainable Development Agenda 21 references everywhere. And, of course, it is Agenda 21 policy that is driving domestic policy, driving our foreign policy, driving our trade policy, and these free trade agreements. It is all Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is the remake of the world in the image of central power. Central power held by people who are unelected, even unviewed by the public. So it used to sound like a horrible nightmare, and today it is an easily documented fact. And how it is that the Democrat Party, through the Democrat Leadership Council, and the Republican Party, through the International Democrat Union. Now, if you've not heard of that before, you need to check out IDU.org, International Democrat Union, which shows the GOP committed to an international organization that has as its purpose the implementation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And, of course, that means the eradication of the inalienable right principles of the Declaration of Independence. This is the war of all time. It's not being fought with guns. It's being fought with trade agreements, legislation, bills, and other shenanigans that D.C. is deeply enmeshed in all the time, all three branches of government. You know, the direction of the country is simply wrongly aimed. So, Steve...
It's a war. It's being fought with language as well, because you've got these nice, as you put it, warm and fuzzy sounding phrases. You've got phrases like free trade itself that are used in ways that would have jolted even Orwell. and things like that. And if you try to actually sit down and read a trade accord like CAFTA, your eyes are going to glaze over rather fast. I can't figure out who they drafted to write that bureaucratese.
Well, I tell you know, it seems to me they've got a lot of people being paid to do that, and while it may read, it may be a very boring read, they have reasons for these words, for their meanings and their non-meanings.
Oh, well, it's selected very carefully.
Very carefully.
I believe that.
Yes.
I just love it when somebody calls me a conspiracy theorist or something like that. Well, for one thing, it's not a theory. As you noted, this is very easy to document, and it's getting easier all the time because these people have these large documents. Agenda 21 is a perfect example. They're right there on their websites. They are not hiding anymore. Assuming they were at one time, they're very open about what it is they're doing. CAFTA is right there on its own website. And if you're reading down further in the preamble, it says very openly, the very last line on the preamble of aims of CAFTA, contribute to hemispheric integration and provide an impetus toward establishing the free trade area of the Americas. So there you are. It's a stepping stone to the free trade of the Americas, the FTAA.
So going from 8 countries to 34.
Anybody who denies that, you can point them to that line in CAFTA. Either they are ignorant or they are lying. Simple as that.
Now, if you have a question or comment for Dr. Yates, you can call us at the Radio Liberty Network here at 888-245-4237. That's 888-24-LIBERTY. Steve, some people will argue that these trade agreements bring jobs to America. We've got about 20 seconds till we cut to our next break, but can you give us some introduction on how we might deal with that as we come back from break?
Okay, well, nobody said that it created no jobs at all, but the point is there been a balance, has there been any kind of a balance between
job creation? Hold that thought, Steve. We'll be right back.
Oh, okay.
We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Network. We're going to continue to talk with our guest, Dr. Stephen Yates, while some stations break away. And what we're talking about is the job effects, domestic job effects, of these trade agreements.
Oh, sure. There were a few jobs created back with NAFTA, for example. But in my state, anyway, South Carolina, North Carolina, too, there have been thousands of textile mills closed. There have been tens of thousands of jobs lost all across this country. And many of these jobs paid reasonably well. This was the sort of thing that had built up the middle class in these regions. They were replaced by these low-paying service sector jobs. Sometimes they're called Mick jobs, hamburger flipper type jobs, paper pusher jobs, things like that really pay very poorly.
And the loss, of course, is of the manufacturing jobs that move toward cheaper labor sources that are advantaged through these free trade agreements.
Yes, and they move to Mexico.
Phony trade agreements.
And now that. Now it's interesting to note that with CAFTA, some of the Mexicans themselves are worried that that the jobs are going to go to Central America. We'll just have to watch and wait and see.
Okay. Now we have a caller, Susan from Corralitos. Hello, Susan. Are you there?
Yeah.
Hello.
Good evening. Dr. Yates, it's a pleasure to be able to ask you my question.
Oh, thank you.
You talked about hemispheric integration a couple of times.
Yes.
And I know that Simón Bolívar had the idea that the Western Hemisphere could be integrated in 1833, and that this idea has been around for a long time. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about the governmental structure that they might use. I suspect the Organization of American States and or the Summit of the Americas is going to be the vehicle that they use to for the supranational government. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Okay, well, I'm more familiar with the Summit of the Americas that came about in 1994, and the FTAA is their brainchild, their baby, so to speak. So they would build it up that way. They would also build it up through, very likely, the WTO, the World Trade Organization.
And we're going to return with our rest of our audience right now. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw. I'm here with Dr. Stephen Yates, and we have a call from Susan, who has asked Dr. Yates about the political integration of the hemisphere under these concepts, and Dr. Yates is responding with is giving us a response to that.
Okay, I mentioned the Summit of the Americas, 1994, and I began to mention the World Trade Organization, which is for all practical purposes a branch of the UN. So the UN, which United Nations, which has long seen itself as an emerging world government, although they don't call it that anymore. They speak now of global governance. But you're talking about the gradual migration of concentrations of power to these international level bureaucracies where people are not elected and therefore don't answer to the American people or the people of these other nations. And it's not just Americans that are worried about this whole thing.
Yeah, I think in Central America and many South American countries, Ecuador and Venezuela are actively defying the United States on this hemispheric integration right now.
Well, Costa Rica, they're also very, very antsy about it. Now, I have an article here. It was sent to me just today about somebody in Costa Rica. Now, I could just read at least a little of this because it's new material. It just found its way into my hands today. This is from someone in Costa Rica who opposes CAFTA, who thinks it's a bad idea. Let's see, Bolivar Elizondo barely ekes out a living on his 25-acre farm in the mountains where he raises chickens, pigs, pineapples, and a dozen cows. But his biggest worry these days is a free trade agreement with the United States. A man who must do everything by hand with a machete or knife. He depends on selling about 50 pigs a year to finance the rest of his tiny operation. He says he could never compete with the large mechanized meat producers from the United States that are expected to invade the market over the next 20 years if Costa Rica's legislature approves the accord. Of course, they're talking about CAFTA here. Without selling the pigs, I don't know how to survive, he said as he fed his pigs. I can't support myself. I will have to sell this. Who is going to buy it? Not another Costa Rican. It will be a multinational corporation. Now, from there on, it goes on with a description of the Central American Free Trade Agreement that should be familiar to all of us. But it's not just Americans that are worried about this. There's Latinos and Hispanics that are worried about it too. And it's interesting, it's the same fundamental dichotomy. The people pushing these trade accords are always the elites, the powerful, the people at the top or upper echelons of government, the banking establishment, and at the establishments at the top of the multinational corporations.
Well, there's
They're
one
the ones that are going to benefit.
Well, there's one other group that we can't forget, because we all live in a community and we say, well, those elites aren't in my community. But what we have in each of our community are what I call sustainable mercenaries, folks who receive the dollars that get funneled down through the elite, you know, the recycling of our tax dollars, the massive amounts of capital that the NGOs have, and the multinational corporations who then work either through business or through government or through NGO activity at the local level to hand out all these little goodies to get all of the opportunists or the gullible people to do their dirty work for them. In the meantime, the rest of us try to raise our children, run our businesses, and lead our lives, and we find that day by day our liberties are being encroached. And I think more and more people are beginning to understand that sustainable development is about creating a global police state. And no one, I don't care if you're rich or poor, Mexican, American, Canadian, or Chilean, nobody wants to advance toward that condition. And yet we're so far down the road of having our infrastructure created for this this permanent revolution and the global state that goes with it, that we're going to have to do some heady thinking on how to transition ourselves out and away. And that's why I always say we need to, you know, redirect our leadership in this country, because if America pulls out of this tailspin and gets out of this global trade nonsense and restores the idea of genuine free trade, boy, a renaissance around the world that is unimaginable today will follow, because the people of the world will follow the country that stands for the principle that liberty matters. And Susan,
I had one more question for Dr. Yates, if there's time.
Sure is. Go ahead.
Well, he talked about the Summit of the Americas, and Dr. Yates, you said it's mostly a bureaucratic organization, and it's really curious to know. I'm not quite sure who attends the Summit of the Americas. It's certainly not Congress, and yet Congress is quite willing to sign these agreements that give their authority to bureaucrats who attend the Summit of the Americas to make all these deals that are directing what is effectively our foreign policy. Why would they do that? It means that they're giving away their power. I can't see, when I look at our Congress, I don't look at people like that they're doing this. Do they know they're giving away their power, or are they? Why? I don't understand the motivation for it.
Yeah, that's it sounds really paradoxical, because you think about it. Is your congressman really going to vote away his own power?
Right.
I understand that. If I am understanding your question right, now, I think the answer can be found in just looking at the way CAFTA was passed that night in the House, with all the arm twisting that was going on, mm-hmm. within, and particularly all the deal cutting that was going on. Now, you're talking about, when you talk about Congress, you talk about the political animal generally, you're talking about a fundamentally utilitarian creature. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Seems to be the prevailing ethic in Congress these days. So why did these people vote for CAFTA when their constituents didn't want them to, and when they themselves had said they would say no to CAFTA, and when they have been informed, at least in South Carolina anyway, by those of us who claim that they are selling out American sovereignty by doing so, why would they vote for it anyway?
Yeah.
Because somebody cut them a deal, including protectionist type of measures to textile mills here in the Carolinas. That was done. Other things were done, and millions worth of public works mm-hmm. were promised to House members in various places around the country. William Jasper has a new article on this in a forthcoming issue of the New American, describing some of the back of the room, smoke-filled room type deals that went on. But I think if you keep in mind that you're dealing with a utilitarian, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine kind of mindset, you can explain why members of Congress would vote to sell out this country this way.
You know, and I think we can't forget the fact that both parties, Republican and Democrat, are sustainability parties.
Oh, no doubt about it. I'm not distinguishing Democrat from Republican here. We may as well just speak of the Washington Party.
But my point
the
there would be
the sustainability party, if you prefer.
You know, if you're an elected politician, Democrat or Republican, and you don't go along with the sustainability program, you will not get your funding. So when we talk about giving away your power, the only way they get their power is from these internationalist political parties in this country. And if you don't go with the internationalist theme and keep quiet about it at the same time, you simply aren't going to get party money. You'll no longer be in Congress. So I think that the people that we have in Congress today are people who are committed to being in Congress, even if it means selling out the United States, because after all, that's what their parties are telling them to do.
Well, Dr. Gates, thank you very much for your very informed statements on the CAFTA, and I appreciate getting a chance to ask my questions.
Well, sure. Thank you for calling, Susan. Stephen, we've got about 15 minutes or so, and let's talk about CAFTA in terms of we've talked about job dynamics, but there's the issue of the constitutionality of it and what effect it has on sovereignty, and what else do you see, and how would you explain those issues related to the trade policies that we're adopting in this country?
Well, under the question of CAFTA's unconstitutionality is actually quite easy. I mean, Article 1, Section 3, I think it is, or Section 8, Paragraph 3, excuse me, requires that Congress regulate trade with foreign nations. And further on in the Constitution, Article 6, I think it is, designates or specifies that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. There is nothing there that authorizes Congress to delegate or outsource its constitutional requirement.
And how does
to some CAFTA, international organization?
Okay. So you're saying CAFTA outsources trade policy from Congress to the World Trade Organization?
To the World Trade Organization, and more specifically to any number of international tribunals and international bureaucracies that are created by the various chapters in CAFTA. And in the article on newswithviews.com, which you mentioned earlier in the hour, I've enumerated a number of those and provided links where anyone so inclined can check these for himself or herself.
And we have that article posted at the freedom21santacruz.net/radio page. So you can read those details. They're quite compelling, I must say. What is it that these trade agreements do to American sovereignty? I mean, you've established some element of its lack of constitutionality. There may be something more you want to say there, but I certainly don't want to miss the issue of trade policy's effect on national sovereignty.
Well, we've covered that somewhat when we were talking about the regional economic integration. The only thing really useful to add there is, if, I can't remember if I said it or not, that you don't really have economic integration without also bringing in regional political integration, given that the idea of an unregulated, unmicromanaged economy hasn't been on anybody's radar screens, for anybody in power anyway, excuse me, hasn't been on their radar screens in over 75 years, not since the Keynesians took over. So when it says at the end here, contribute to hemispheric integration and provide an impetus toward establishing the free trade area of the Americas, the best thing I can recommend people do is go to that particular website and start reading the FTAA. And you will quickly come to realize, if you study it, that if the FTAA becomes passed, then U.S. sovereignty is history, because there are provisions there that would supersede any federal, state, national laws. The bureaucracies could overrule them.
Wow. Well, I have a quote that I got from you in your article from Vicente Fox in 2002. He said, "Eventually our long-range objective is to establish with the United States, but also with Canada, our regional partner, an ensemble of connections and institutions similar to those created by the European Union, with the goal of attending to future themes such as the future prosperity of North America and the movement of capital, goods, services, and persons." So that's a pretty clear indication from the President of Mexico of what the intent of these trade agreements and regional policies is to be. It's the amalgamation of North America into one country, presumably with ultimately one currency, just as happened in Europe.
Oh, sure. Vicente Fox is a globalist. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And it's interesting that that you mentioned that. He made that statement in Madrid. Now, there has been a document that just appeared within the last 2 or 3 months. I'm not sure just when it appeared. It first came to my attention about 6 weeks ago. It's on the website of the shadowy Council on Foreign Relations, which is often spoken of in this context. But the title of this 59-page document is Building a North American Community. It's the product of, they call themselves, an independent task force sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations with the Canadian Council of Chief Executives and the, Consejo Mexicano de Asuntos Internacionales, which is the Mexican equivalent.
Now, what role does the United States have in this? As I understand it, that's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. What role does the U.S. have in this?
Well, the U.S. would be submerged into the larger megastate, which would include Mexico and Canada. And it's interesting that these were the three NAFTA nations. How long will it be before they pull in the six CAFTA countries into this rapidly expanding megastate? And here again, people say this is a conspiracy theory. There it is. They're not hiding. There's no conspiracy here, and it's as much a fact as gravity. There it is on the website.
And we
anybody can download it and read it for himself.
And we've got this document also posted at our radio page, so you can go into that and review this document as well. We have Lorna from Idaho on the line. Lorna, do you have a question for Dr. Yates?
Yes. By the way, I've been on the Summit of the Americas website, and it is quite amazing, the hemispheric integration with, I think it's, 32 or 23 other countries or something?
34.
Oh, is it? Yeah. And, I mean, it's not only UNESCO, it's sustainable development, I mean, everything. But my question is the charter that we signed on September 11th, that Colin Powell signed for the Organization of the Americas, what impact does that have on us?
Let's see, what is the name of that document?
It's the charter that we signed for the Organization of the Americas.
Okay, I'm less familiar with that.
Ooh, yeah, if you go into the website and you go into the partners and it's the Organization of the Americas, and it was signed on 2001, September 11th, when we got bombed, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
That's very interesting. There's always...
Now, of course, there are so many of these documents in existence now. It's
the
point where it's impossible to keep track of them all.
We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show in just a moment. I'm back here while some stations break, continuing our discussion with Dr. Stephen Yates on CAFTA and trade agreements in the United States. Thank you very much, Lorna, for your call to the show tonight. Dr. Yates, is it true that the free trade policies are, these phony free trade policies are always involving partners. It seems that wherever you go now in terms of economic talk, it's always about partners. It's the partnership between America, Mexico, and Canada. It's the partnership between the federal government and your local school board. It's the partnership between your local home builder and the local planning department and the federal agency that's funding them. It's all about partners. There's no talk any longer about free enterprise and the protection of private property. It seems to me that all these trade notions just really solidify this idea of partnership. And of course, Mussolini never used the word partner, but it's really the same economic system, is it not?
Well, yes, basically. It's kind of a corporatist kind of system. And Mussolini once said that corporatism was a better term for what he believed than fascism, because corporatism combines, I forget the exact words, combines the economic resources of business with the power of government to get things done. If you combine corporate power with government power, that's the definition of a public-private partnership.
You're right, that's
the buzzword of the day. Everybody is partnering with everybody else, and it's one grand collectivist kind of system.
You know, it's tough to partner with the agent of force. You know, they used to when I was a boy, when the government got in bed with partners looking to sign to seal their own pocket, it was called the mob. You know, and today we've legitimized mob-type actions by legitimizing the idea that the force of government can partner with their friends. And that's how we end up with the kinds of eminent domain decisions that came down earlier in the summer, and even some worser decisions that came down before that. And for those who don't know what I'm referring to there, it's the Lingle versus Chevron Supreme Court case, which unanimously held that due process requirements in property cases was to be a very low standard. In other words, whatever the government wants, the government, local government gets, which allows for this unlimited formation of partnerships at the local level. And boy, there's no easier way to describe tyranny than what happened in Italy as a result from that economic experiment back in the 30s and 40s. We're going to welcome our audience back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station just now. Welcome back to our concluding minutes here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station and our interview with Dr. Stephen Yates on the question of the phony free trade agreements that are selling America down, down, down. You know, one question that I have we didn't cover earlier, and that is the issue of how it is we get these trade agreements passed by simple majority votes, when one would think an international trade agreement would have something to do with a treaty provision as opposed to a standard bill. Is that
true?
Well,
they call it agreement. They call it an agreement rather than a treaty in order to circumvent the constitutional requirement that a treaty be signed by, I think, two-thirds of the Senate. A simple majority can sign and pass an agreement. So, again, as I said earlier, this is as much a war of words as it is anything else.
Well, we see that kind of manipulation right here in Santa Cruz, where it's clear that to impose certain taxes, two-third requirements are imposed, and yet, you know, water districts will go impose a water tax and sometimes do it without even a vote, and always claiming that they only need a 50% majority. We also have Roger on the phone from Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question for us this evening?
Yeah, thanks, gents. I guess you're just about out of time, but there's an unfortunately a necessary manner in which I think we kind of lost the CAFTA debate because it wasn't much intellectually robust. I don't know if that's going to be the swaying factor, but, you know, on the one hand, you had Pat Buchanan casting raw protectionism rather than tariffs for revenues. I think that's a big mistake, or an alternate to the income tax, or one that's very attractive. On the other hand, you got Coalition for Fair Trade. That's the code word for your stock liberal type of arguments. And there I am spitting nails with a local radio show having this guy on against it. I'm thinking, that's what I had to go by. I might have been forecast. My point was on the, and I hope you revisit this soon, because it's on the outright lies of the pro-capitalist forces, because they really, they just pretend to use the libertarian stream arguments, but then they only selectively appropriate, and then they won't allow natural market corrections to take place, but instead it's IMF bailouts to facilitate their so-called free trade. And the brilliant libertarian stream folks point out, you know, that if you wanted to have true free trade, all you need is 2-3 pages, but if you want to have a trade protection racket for the well-connected, then you need 2,400-some pages to pull that off.
Yes, I agree completely.
Well, you know, there's an element within the libertarian group that has really led us into this abyss.
But I disagree with some of their arguments myself. It's just that some of them are very good, but we can just prove that they're liars on their basic premise.
If we stick to the premise, disclose the premise, and it's honest, it works.
That they're liars on that basic premise, that they merely pretend to be libertarian stream borrowers, but they're really not.
I'd say precisely right. And on the other hand, you've got the Green Party and their land use movement, and it's nothing but a land grab for corporate socialist benefits, and it's nothing to do with the protection of anything that the local folks are interested in having protected. It's about amalgamating power, centralizing it, and moving forward that way. Roger, we want to thank you very much for your call. We're about out of time here, and I want to thank Dr. Yates for being with us. I want to. You have a book. While we end up here, can you tell us about the book and how people might avail themselves of that book?
Yeah, the book is kind of on a different subject. Of course, trade agreements are not my only obsession, but I should note that they're in connection with the earlier gentleman's call that there are people who opposed CAFTA for the wrong reason, because they saw that it's not socialist enough.
We're going to run out of time here, but that was certainly Congressman Sam Farr here in the coast of California. But you can check our website for more information on Dr. Yates, and you can get his book, and we'll go forward from there.
You could get the book from exlibris.com.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome to tonight's second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm your host this evening, Michael Shaw, and our guest this second hour is Dr. David Abbott. Our subject is how trade policies, regionalization, and the European Union have destroyed English independence. British citizen and part-time U.S. resident David Abbott describes how England is losing control over its own governance. England is quickly becoming regionalized under European Union authority. In the process, Britons are losing control over land use decisions and domestic lawmaking. Learn the history of how the European Union has used trade policy to destroy national sovereignty. This interview will assist us in understanding the real purpose behind CAFTA, the Free Trade of Americans Agreement, and the American process of regionalization. I want to welcome Dr. Abbott to our show tonight. He is a medical doctor practicing in Portland, Oregon. He's a British citizen and a recent candidate under the United Kingdom Independent Party for the British Parliament. He has a unique view of the transatlantic process for regionalizing continents, both Europe and North America. Dr. Abbott will describe how the European Union is an immediate threat to the sovereignty of England. Wow, is this where Bush and Clinton are leading America? Well, let's get down to some facts about England and their trade policies and what it's meant for the political disintegration of the English society. Dr. Abbott, are you there?
I'm here.
Well,
yes.
It's good to hear your voice. I would also say that Dr. Abbott gave an address at the Freedom 21 conference in Reno last month, and boy, I tell you, you opened a lot of people's eyes to the fact that what we're experiencing here in America is just a replica of so many of the things that have already happened in England. And, you know, if the mother country goes the wrong way, that puts America in a desperate strait. And together, I think, by understanding the common globalist effects that are occurring in England and the United States, we might be able to avert this train wreck and bring both our countries and the world to follow back on a course of health and happiness. So what is it that you can begin to tell us about England's experience in the...
Well, as Dr. Yates was saying, it was falsely sold to us. What's now the European Union started out as the common market, and they sold it to us as a free trade area. It never was that from the beginning. It was a customs union, which is a slightly different thing anyway. But, you know, free trade sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, it's the same as sustainable development sounds good. But once you scratch beneath the surface, you find there are a lot of problems. And, of course, from the beginning, with the European Union or the common market, even though it was falsely sold to us as a free trade area, there always was a political agenda. And the people at the top, Mr. Heath in the case of Britain, and the other political leaders, knew that from the beginning. But they knew that it wouldn't be acceptable to the British people, and so it was sort of covered up and presented as a free trade area initially. We've gone on through successive treaties. So we've got to the point now where Britain makes only 20% of its own laws. The other 80% are made by the European Union.
Wow, and that has to be shocking. How many people in England are aware of that? We're going to break here for some stations to take a commercial break, and we'll be right back with Dr. David Abbott and talking about the European Union. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Talking with Dr. David Abbott about England and the European Union. And while some stations have broken away, let's continue with our conversation and proceed, please, David.
I just want to correct you on one little thing, Michael. Of course, it's, you know, the United Kingdom is Britain and Northern Ireland, and Britain is England, Scotland, and Wales, and the Welsh and the Scots and the Northern Irish get slightly miffed when we refer to the whole entity as England. And so it would be great if we could use the term Britain when we were talking to about the whole entity, you see.
Okay.
Or the United Kingdom would be even better.
All right.
Because this has it, the reason why I'm making this distinction is to do with regionalization policy, which we will talk about later on. But
thank you.
As I said, 20% of the laws are made at home by the British Parliament. The other 80% are imposed by the EU, and they're not even made by the European Parliament. They're made by bodies which are mostly the commissioners, the European commissioners, who are appointed. They're not elected, and they basically do the will of the bureaucrats who meet in smoke-filled rooms and decide what laws they're going to present to the commissioners. The role of the Parliament is only to rubber stamp, the European Parliament is just to rubber stamp those laws, and they then go out to the national parliaments, where they're either rubber stamped or completely bypass the Parliament and enter directly into national law. It's a terrible system. It's completely the opposite of democracy.
Now, how many people, how many Britons understand that 80% of your current law is coming through a bureaucracy in Brussels?
Probably very few, but the number of people who understand that something very bad is going on at the European Union level is growing by the day. Now, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, it just shows you the failure of democracy in that the three main political parties in Britain all support Britain's continued membership of the European Union, and yet polls have shown an increasing number of people who do not want to be in the European Union. And just very recently, there was a substantial independent poll done, and the people were asked, first of all, do you want to have a referendum on whether Britain should remain in the European Union? This is not whether Britain should join up with the Constitution, but whether Britain should actually remain in the European Union. And 62% said we should have a referendum.
64.
They were then asked...
We'll be right back here at Freedom 21. We're back here with our guest, Dr. David Abbott, discussing the European Union and Great Britain. And he's described how the political parties are all the three largest political parties are all behind the European Union, but that how public support for the idea of remaining I guess it's not remaining, the public support for the European Union in general is eroding rather quickly.
That's right. And 50% of people said that they would vote to leave the European Union. 34% said they would vote to stay in, and the rest were the don't knows. So it's the first time we've had a majority wanting to actually leave the European Union. And, you know, at some point, the political... politicians, the political elites have to realize this is what the people are thinking. Now, our party, my party, the UK Independence Party, is the only party that has from the beginning, from its inception 11 years ago, has campaigned for us, for Britain, to leave the European Union. Actually, we would like to see the European Union disintegrate for the sake not only of Britain, but also the other countries that are in it. They would all be much better off with a different sort of arrangement.
Well, the regionalization does standardize law everywhere, done by bureaucratic edict. It really transforms the whole Anglo-American dynamic that's gone on for centuries of expanding human liberty. This is the wholesale contraction of it, and of course they're warm and fuzzy to get control, and you know, the boot comes down later once you consolidate power like the United Nations, the European Union, the World Trade Organizations, and the other global governance organizations would do, and as our leaders, you know, every party in America supports these ideas generally. No party in America is standing against regionalization. So I'm very glad for the United Kingdom Independence Party. It is a party that Americans must replicate and move forward with these kinds of independent ideas.
Yes, that's right. I would hate to see America get, you know, so sucked into NAFTA or CAFTA or the America's free trade area that they lost the amount of independence that Britain has already lost. We were very fearful that, and we still are fearful, that the Constitution would somehow be imposed on us, because then we would not have the possibility of leaving the arrangement without military action. But so far we're just bound in by treaties. And, you know, treaties get broken all the time. So if the right party, hopefully ours, or some combination of other parties, gets into power, we could break these treaties and restore sovereignty to Britain and start making our own laws again. and have an accountable government.
Well, how are you doing in respect to spreading the word to British citizens that they've lost control over their lawmaking, and as I understand it, even have lost control over their land use decisions at local levels to globalist regional organizations that are now making those decisions? How is it that word is being spread?
Well, the print media are pretty good. There are several large circulation papers that realize, at least somewhat realize, how bad the situation is, and are spreading the word. The broadcast media are not very good. The BBC is popularly dubbed the Brussels Broadcasting Corporation. It gets a certain amount of funding, actually, from Brussels, although they claim it's a sort of independent subsidiary. But you would think that the EU is nothing but a very good thing if you listen to the broadcast media. There are one or two small stations that challenge it. There's a station called Talk Sport, believe it or not, that has a political agenda that's more in line with ours. But generally, the broadcast media are pretty hopeless. The print media is good. The blogging community is fairly good. And, of course, our party's been trying to spread the word. And starting this fall, in late September, we're going to start a very big campaign to demand a referendum. We hope to get 1 million signatures to demand a referendum that on Britain's staying in the EU. In other words, we want to leave the European Union, and we hope to have enough popular pressure and support from the sympathetic print media that we can really make an impact and draw people's attention to how bad the current situation is.
Well, that has to be Tony Blair's worst nightmare.
Yes. Do you know, Tony Blair, before he became leader of the Labour Party, when he was standing for election at his constituency in the north of England, said, when we're in power, at that time the Tories were in power, when we're in power we will leave the European Union because the European Union is stealing British wealth and British jobs. And then once he got into power, he did a complete flip-flop, and now, of course, you know, he would secretly like to be the president of the European Union.
Well,
and he signed every document that they put in front of him, including the Constitution. You know, he signed the Constitution, but it has yet to be ratified by the UK.
My... Well, we've had shows earlier and talked about Tony Blair and his past chairmanship of the British Fabian Society.
Yes.
And, you know, it's one thing's very clear. If you're a real Fabian penetrator, there's no boundary imposed on you by truth.
No. Well put.
You know, there's a website that that you pointed us to and that we have on our radio page tonight called, is it the Bruges Group?
A Bruges Group, yes. Bruges was the town in Belgium where Mrs. Thatcher made a speech at which she expressed regret at the European Union and urged changes.
Huh.
Bruges Group.
Well, they make the point that the European Union will ensure that national parliaments lose significant powers to European Union institutions, and that the European Union's powers into justice and home affairs will be expanded. The power over external border controls and internal security, that means homeland security, the equivalent gets controlled by Brussels in England. And
well, it's already all immigration and asylum policy is decided in Brussels, all of it.
So you, England, Britain cannot make decisions about immigration policies without approval from the UN delegatee, the European Union, without their consent.
That's true. And this works in various ways, but asylum and immigration policy is entirely decided in Brussels. If somebody gets into the country, they basically can never be thrown out because of the provisions in the human rights legislation. You know, Britain passed the Human Rights Act, which incorporates the European Convention on Human Rights, which is very similar to the UN Convention on Human Rights, was the same. And all sorts of unintended consequences have stemmed from that. Basically, no one can be deported. In fact, we have sitting in British jails at the moment people that are wanted in the States for terrorists, But because the states has the death penalty, they cannot be extradited to the U.S. because of the Human Rights Act.
My. Well, it is a clever plan. People used to think that it was just too preposterous to take seriously, but now wherever you look, the walls are closing in. They've certainly closed in more quickly in Britain than they have in the United States. You know, I made reference a bit ago to the Fabian Society. Let me read a quote that came out of the first edition of the American Fabian and get your reaction to it. This is written in 1895. And the author says, "We call our paper the American Fabian for two reasons. We call it Fabian because we desire to make it stand for the kind of educational socialist work which is so ably done by English Fabian Society. We call our paper the American Fabian because our politics must in a measure, differ from those of English Fabians. England and America are alike in some things. In some things they are utterly unlike. England's unwritten constitution readily admits of constant, though gradual, modification. Our American constitution does not readily admit such change. England can thus move into socialism almost imperceptibly. Our constitution, being largely individualistic, must be changed to admit of socialism, and each change necessitates a political crisis. That means the raising of great new issues."
Well, that's wonderful, isn't it? Of course, we call it salami slicing. You know, the introduction of socialism through the mechanism of the EU. It's all these, every little law that you can make, a new law that's made without there being any democratic input, and it's imposed on us. It may seem to have some benefit or some reason for it at the time, but the cumulative effect is the imposition of an extraordinarily rigid socialist doctrine on the whole country. However, we still like the cataclysmic catastrophes. 9/11 was called a beneficial crisis. So was the foot and mouth epidemic that we had in Britain, a beneficial crisis. And, you know, it's amazing how, for instance, after 9/11, they suddenly trot out all this pre-prepared legislation that can further, you know, suppress us, that they've had waiting on the books, waiting for an opportunity to wheel it out. And so we like we can do the salami slicing, but we also like the big events so that we can take a great step forward.
Well, you know, crisis seems to be the methodology for advancing this new paradigm. And, you know, the people, you know, there's always this discussion of left-right divide, and, you know, I'm increasingly convinced that the divide needs to be between ordinary people and the powercrats.
Exactly.
But, you know, when you look at people who have championed socialist ideas, we're now getting to the point where one can readily see that socialism does mean a police state.
Yes, it does. I mean, there are a lot of well-meaning socialists. And in fact, in our party, we have a lot of people who are escapees from the Labour Party, who realize that, you know, socialism isn't power to the people, it's power to the elite, it is the development of a police state. We've had some terrible moves towards Britain becoming a police state in the last few months.
We'll be right back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, Dr. David Abbott.
After spearheading efforts to implement the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda in Santa Cruz, California, Congressman Sam Farr wrote,
"I am writing to congratulate you, the Advisory Board, and the Action Santa Cruz County Coalition for completing the Local Agenda 21 Action Plan."
Congressman Sam Farr then wrote,
"The Local Agenda 21 Action Plan not only has local significance, it also will have regional and national impacts. As you know, the President's Council on Sustainable Development is beginning Phase 3 of its work, with an emphasis on sustainable communities."
Sam Farr continued,
"I have been spearheading a similar effort to develop a process of sustainable development planning for the entire region."
So why does Sam Farr now say he's never heard of United Nations Agenda 21?
Yes, Congressman Farr, I'd like your my name's Daniel Beckett. I'd like your comments on the United Nations Agenda 21 program that you're implementing here. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But you endorsed it, sir. I have your paperwork.
United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda 21. If there's nothing to hide, why does Sam now deny it? This has been a public service question posed by Freedom 21 Santa Cruz at freedom21santacruz.net, inviting you to advance the cause of freedom in the 21st century. For more information about how you can advance the cause of freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. Some of our stations are still at break, so let me just remind the listeners who weren't with us for the first hour that a number of tools, neighborhood tools, have been developed for disseminating the information and coming to your own understanding of what Sustainable Development Agenda 21 is all about. You know, those tools include the Taking Liberty, Understanding the Wildlands Project, developed by Dr. Michael Kaufman, that'll really take you through how it is that our rural lands are being chewed up by the federal government and its partners. And then there's the recently issued CD called The War on Reason, 8 hours of interviews here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and don't forget the guide, Understanding Sustainable Development Agenda 21. We're going to be right back here at Freedom 21. Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, Dr. David Abbott. And David, can you tell us about the history of the common market and how we got to the European Union, and maybe draw some comparisons with what you see for American policy as it's being developed today?
Well, as I said, back in 1972, the then Labour Party took us into the common market. This was after Harold Macmillan of the Conservatives, who was a Fabian. These all, you know, all these people have been Fabians at one time or another in their life, it's true. We were taken in. It was supposed to be a free trade area. We signed the Treaty of Rome. In order to please our European partners even more, the night before they signed, Mr. Heath agreed to give away all Britain's fish. The Europeans have used small nets and fished out the Mediterranean and fished out the coasts of Spain and France. We had 80% of the fish stocks, which had been sustained. It had been a sustainable catch for years. It's now handed over. It's called a community resource, and of course it's been decimated by the nets of the Spanish trawlers and so on. Things gradually progressed from there. We had various other treaties, including the Maastricht Treaty, and I just want to pause there for a moment, because by the time we got to the Maastricht Treaty, about 10 years ago, the penny was beginning to drop. There were patriotic people in Parliament who did not like this, and in order for the Maastricht Treaty to get through Parliament, there was an enormous amount of arm twisting and bribery and threats and bullying that took place, and it squeaked by a handful of votes. Now, it just reminded me of the description of the CAFTA vote, you know, which I think went by one or two votes, didn't it, through Congress. And it's it just is following, the Casper thing is just exactly following in so many ways what happened with the development of the European Union. Maastricht introduced the regionalization concept. Then we had the Nice Treaty, and of course now we're on the verge of having the constitution.
Let me ask you, how did that treaty bring about the regionalization policy?
In the Maastricht Treaty, and actually the official title of the European Union is the European Union of the Regions, and it established the Committee of the Regions, and these regions, which are substantial areas of each country, report directly to Brussels, bypassing the national parliaments. For instance, my region is the southeast region, and they have an office in Brussels, and they get grants from Brussels, which of course is just British tax money that's coming back to them after it's sloshed around in the leaky pipes of Brussels. They establish a relationship with Brussels, they look to Brussels for funding, and so on and so forth.
And so they, in looking to Brussels for funding, they're writing their grant receipts based upon what it is Brussels wants to hear. And this regionalization policy is, as I'm always saying here in America, regionalizing America, whether it's air boards or water boards or other kinds of advisory councils, are all established for the purpose of blurring political boundaries. Because if you can blur the political boundary and raid the treasury, it's just a long-known axiom of politics that then you can gather the riches of all the people.
Yes, and that is exactly what's going on. And of course, you know, this regionalization has very sinister implications. It's even going to affect defense policy. The army and is being restructured to fit into the regional structure, Of course, the whole defense procurement thing is being geared to, they have to get all their kit from a European provider. I mean, one consequence of that is that whereas we used to buy a lot of things from America, we used to make a lot of stuff ourselves, but an F-16 costs, I think, about $20 million dollars. The European fighter, which isn't yet operational, and it's taken years and years and years in development, and it'll be out of date by the time we get it, is about three times that much. But we have to get that because it's European. It makes no sense.
Wow.
And it's going to undermine NATO, and it's going to drive a wedge between Britain and the US.
So these regionalizing organizations, whether it's the North American regionalization or the European regionalization, have enormous effects on other aspects of public policy that people might not anticipate.
Well, they do. And as Dr. Yates was saying, it starts out as free trade, but hard on the heels of that is free movement of people, and we, Britain is a crowded country. People have never been asked about whether they want more immigration, but we have an enormously growing population. You know, the countryside is being eaten up with new development to accommodate everybody. Everything's much more crowded. The roads are more crowded. The schools are more crowded, and so on. Hospitals are crowded because there isn't the infrastructure to cope with the increased population.
So out of the EU, you're getting control of your trade policies, your immigration policies, your political processing policies. The essence of what makes an independent nation have been compromised.
Absolutely. And of course, our history, the same as the history of America, is very different from other nations' history in that we have, it's always been understood that you can do more or less whatever you want to do unless it's forbidden by the law. I mean, that's how sort of common law has grown up. Whereas the European model, which is the one that's now being sort of forced on us, is that you can only do what is allowed by your political masters. In other words, freedom is limited to what they say it can be. And that is a very significant basic difference between the British on the one hand and the continental Europeans on the other.
Well, that's the great glory of the thinking of John Locke and what preceded him and what came afterward.
Exactly.
And what's happening is that mankind's greatest hope, the Anglo-American tradition of common law and the recognition of a natural law and a higher law, is all coming apart.
It's coming apart. I mean, the Human Rights Act, which I've mentioned before, and some of the consequences of that, let me tell you. This, you know, is supplanting the sort of natural law, common law aspects of British law. Now, Mrs. Blair is a lawyer, Tony Blair's wife, Sherry, and she represented a 15-year-old Muslim girl who was at a school where I think almost everybody was a Muslim. The headmistress was a Muslim, and they had a dress code, you know, they had a school uniform, as is common in England, and indeed in Britain, and it included being able to wear a Muslim outfit, which left the face exposed. This girl wanted to wear the full Muslim gown, where you peek out through the little thing that only shows the eyes, and she was represented by Mrs. Sherry Blair. Under the Human Rights Act, she got permission to do that, to wear this full Muslim gown. Now, the consequences of that are enormous, because it means that...
Hold that for a second, and we'll be right back here at Freedom 21. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. David Abbott, talking about the European Union and its effect on Britons and Great Britain generally. And he's described the difference in the history of the development of European law and British law and subsequently American law as being key and essential to the whole dynamic of how it is that people lead their lives and how that's being eroded very rapidly by terms of the European Union in Great Britain. And specifically, as we broke back with the rest of our audience, he was describing how the Commission on Human Rights, and
it's the European Convention on Human Rights,
and how it affects how it's showing itself in a particular case with the dress codes at school.
That's right. And you see, there are a lot of Muslim girls in Britain who would like, we believe, to be more integrated with the mainstream of British society. Of course, they're under pressure from their families very often not to do that and to, you know, wear the full Muslim gown and so on and so forth. And often they could say, well, the school uniform is this, so I have to wear it. But now, after Mrs. Blair won this case, it means that they can now have no weapon with which to withstand pressure from the family to go into this sort of exclusive Muslim mode, wearing the full Muslim gown. And that's only going to cause further disintegration of society. I mean, I mention this as one of the sort of, who could anticipate that as a consequence of the Human Rights Act, but there it is.
Well, of course, here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, we're hardcore advocates of the relationship between a parent and a child. But I think what this illustration points out to me nonetheless is that the policies, the immigration policies, the follow-up trade policies, the open border policies are designed to disorient societies. The immigrating society as well as the established society, when it happens at the pace that immigration has been happening at in England or immigration here in the United States. It's just beyond a culture's ability to absorb and amalgamate. And this is understood by those who are promoting these policies, and it's designed in order to create the kind of division and hostility that makes regionalization and centralization of power simpler. Talk about the EU in terms of corruption. I mean, we hear a lot, increasing amount anyway, about how the United Nations has been found to be corrupt in so many ways. Is the European Union a more efficient model of a global governance dynamic?
It is intensely corrupt. They have a court of auditors who are supposed to audit the books every year. They have failed to pass the audit for the last 10 years in a row. 10 years. There are billions and billions and billions unaccounted for. There are over 2,000 overseas bank accounts that the EU maintains, and nobody knows what they're for. There's a lot of nepotism. The expense account fiddling is just extraordinary and recognized. And if somebody blows the whistle, they get fired. There have been 3 whistleblowers who have, lost their jobs because they pointed out what was going on. They appointed the British, then one of the British commissioners, Neil Kinnock, who was an ex-leader of the Labour Party, to head an anti-corruption drive, and it was a complete and utter joke. I mean, his wife also works for the EU, as does one of his children. I mean, once you get in there, you can you're fixed for life, and you're also immune from prosecution. The people that work for the EU cannot be prosecuted, and that's a lifetime protection. Their premises can't be searched, and so they can get away with whatever they want to get away with. It is the beginnings of an extraordinarily corrupt arrangement.
Well, it's a legalized mob.
Yeah.
I mean, one really can't expect public-private partnerships, that is, the power of force combining with their buddies, not to become just that.
No. And that's what it is. You see, the big organizations have the lobbying power to influence the legislation at the level of the bureaucrats that make the laws that go to the commission. This is one of the reasons why the vitamin directive, you see, has been able to go through, because the sort of mom-and-pop operations that supplied many of the vitamins in Britain, the same as they do in the States, are going to be unable to afford all the testing that is required to be able to sell vitamins throughout the European Union, and so and other food supplements. And so, you know, they were able to put the small businesses out of business by their lobbying power. They say that if you're working in the European Union and you feel slightly hungry, you can just look round and there'll be a lobbyist waiting to buy you lunch wherever you want to go.
Wow.
They're completely unregulated. As in the US, you know, lobbyists have to register. There, in Brussels, there are 15,000 lobbyists unregistered, and nobody knows what they're getting up to. But one thing is that they're all supporting people who can afford lobbyists, if you see what I mean.
I understand that. And meanwhile, the regulations that come out of that destroy small businesses and the families that that rely on those small businesses for jobs, and it harms all of us as consumers, because it's going to have an increasingly downward effect on our standards of living. And I think most Americans understand how the middle class in Europe has been getting thinner and thinner, and we begin to see our own middle class being peeled back layer by layer. While we continue to subsidize what I call the sustainable mercenaries who take money and go out and take college PhDs and have them study the movement of frogs. I had an environmental magazine that came across my desk last week that was entitled Toad Tunnels and Big Victory in U.S. Congress. And they were so pleased because the Congress had allocated $3 billion for the construction of toad tunnels. I'm not joking. I'm talking about tunnels that go under roads so that toads can pass. So that's how our economy in the United States is being buoyed up. And of course, you can't print out funny money and give it for ditch digging efforts and have it sustain itself. And so I'm beginning to think increasingly that this whole sustainable development movement is a guise to cover up a failing monetary system, where the guys who are in control of this monetary system don't want to lose power, and so they're telling us all to get used to shortage and crisis while they create this crisis in an effort to maintain their power. And everything I hear about England or Britain tends to confirm that observation.
Well, you know, they say that there have been a lot of jobs created in Britain in the last since the present government has been in, but almost all of those new jobs are in government. And almost all of those jobs are doing things that are mandated one way or another by EU regulations. And, you know, the cost, you mentioned the cost of compliance. It's been estimated that the cost of complying with the regulations for a small company is seven times what it, you know, per unit of production, what it is for a large company. So you can see how the imposition of these regulations favors the large companies at the expense of the small companies. And, you know, we're getting this sort of horrible combination between capitalism and the fascist European state.
Well, you know, we've had a guest, Terry Hayfield, who will contend that British-American capitalism is exactly that, designed to create a global corporate socialism that that then goes into an even worse economic dynamic for human beings. And this style of capitalism, corporate capitalism, does not rely on the principles of free trade and private property.
No.
It's not about engaging with your fellow human being on a mutually satisfactory basis. It's about rules, regulations, conformity, and carrots and sticks. Sticks for those who don't conform, and carrots for those who do. It reminds me of the poor victims of their own government in the Gaza Strip, just having their homes torn down in front of their eyes, and those who didn't like it were even put in jail.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Gaza Strip, I mean, they were, it wasn't that long ago, 30 years ago, that the Israeli government encouraged those settlers to go there. And then they've been there 30 years, and then they uproot them and toss them out. And meanwhile, they're going to, you know, establish all the Palestinians there, with new housing provided by somebody or another. I mean, you have mentioned the Pathfinder scheme in the north of England, where Mr. Prescott, who is the Deputy Prime Minister, is seeking to destroy some well-established communities with brick-built houses and replace them with modern, probably high-rise housing, which is going to completely disorient the local community, and it, for the purpose, apparently, of saving a little bit of electricity, rather than insulating the existing houses, which could be done much, much cheaper, whole communities are going to be destroyed. This gives the government, I think, control over communities with this, when you uproot them like this. And, you know, that sort of thing has been going on in Britain with the development of new towns and so on for quite a long time, and it seems to be gathering pace.
Well, and that program has begun here in the United States. Of course, the one that's famous is the Kelo case, the eminent domain case out of Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
But right here in Santa Cruz, you know, mobile home parks aren't allowed to be improved, and then they're condemned and demolished, and people then are put into government housing, and rules are strict, and you know, and the edict, the statement from the from those who operate these confines is, well, if you don't like our rules, you better start. And that's the attitude. The attitude is that people are chattel, and the infrastructure of what I call the post-private property era is being built with the dollars that are going to bury our monetary system in debt. And so we lose on both sides of the coin, and yet, you know, in one very sad way, to date, we've been sanctioning our own victimhood. But it seems to me that awareness is growing. And you seem to be confirming that in England. Talk a little bit about how the United Independent...
UK Independence Party.
Yes.
Yeah. We are 11 years old. We have fought all the elections in the last 11 years, all the national elections, and the European elections. Now, we do not approve of proportional representation. We think that's an insult to... the British way of doing things. I mean, you should elect somebody and you know who's representing you. But the European system is that you have a party list, and it's a form of proportional representation. That, of course, favors small parties. And in the elections last year, 2004, for the European Parliament, we had 12 MEPs elected. In some areas, we were the second most successful party, and overall we got 17% of the vote. You know, and this is when you think that there are three well-established parties, that was a tremendous success. We rattled the establishment at that time, and it was as a consequence of our doing so well in that election that Mr. Blair promised that we would have a referendum on the election. In fact, what he said is, that is a government promise. So, of course, subsequently he said we weren't going to have one, but so we know what government promises are worth.
At least they're from Tony Blair.
Yeah, but we think that he chatted to the French, Monsieur Chirac, and so Chirac said, oh, he'd have a referendum for the French people, everybody assuming the French would vote wholeheartedly for it, but they did, this was a referendum on the Constitution, not on staying in the European Union. I'm talking about a referendum on the European Constitution, so the French had their referendum, and of course the French people voted against it, and indeed that influenced the Dutch referendum, which followed shortly behind, and that they voted against it. So it really did. We think we take credit in our party for having sort of turned the tide of history by doing well in the European elections last year.
Well, I think it's that kind of bootstrap effort that has served humanity so well over the eons, and now is the time for us to give one big thrust to do exactly the kind of things that you and so many other people in Britain are doing. We've got about 10 minutes left in our show. If you've got a question for Dr. Abbott, our phone number is 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Well, the regional assemblies that you've discussed a bit in England, explain how a regional assembly works, where the authority comes from, and the kinds of things that these Brussels-directed regional assemblies do.
Well, it's interesting. Of course, Wales got voted to have a regional assembly. It is already, there was a certain movement wanting to have some measure of independence. The government spent a lot of money persuading the Welsh to vote that way, and they just squeaked it through. Like so many of these things, they just squeaked through. It's most peculiar. The Scots have their own parliament, which is a form of regional assembly, very corrupt, as it turns out, and the Northern Irish do too. Splitting up England was a lot trickier, and the government set up these bodies, but they're extrajudicial. I mean, there is no statute that has set these bodies up. They're private corporations. It is the most extraordinary arrangement. And they are incurring, they're taking on staff with pension arrangements and so on and so forth. And we believe that the assembly people that are authorizing this are going to become personally liable for some of the obligations that they're taking on. It's a very interesting situation. It is another layer of bureaucracy. And they have several functions, but the main one is planning policy, as you say, and they do talk about sustainable development. I have to say, Michael, that until you alerted me to this phrase, it had passed me over, but it's in all their literature, sustainable development.
And you have to go into any community anywhere in the world and say, this is a local program. You know, this global to local is always a local program, but if you go two counties over, you find they got the same document that you've got. I mean, we've had guests and callers from all over the country saying, we really got onto this when we found out that across the state, this independent idea designed for our county was being sold to these other people by the same salesman.
Yeah.
So it's it seems that in England, while you're doing it through Brussels, here we take on the local regionalization actually through our federal government, which of course is a major breach of the separation of powers and the idea of state authority.
Well, I used to be active in sort of local affairs in Oregon, and I remember 10 years or more ago going to a meeting about the future of the town I lived in then. It was called a visioning meeting. And
watch out for that. If you haven't heard that term, audience, of visioning, listen to what Dr. Abbott's about to tell us.
Well, then I go to a meeting of the South East of England Regional Assembly. It's the same deal. you know, they're all reading from the same playbook.
That they are. And I think that playbook is the same in Britain as it is in the United States.
Yes.
We have Fred, caller on the line. Fred, do you have a question for Dr. Abbott?
Yes. Good evening. Some people see all of these people that are trying to do us ill and ascribe it to satanic forces. Do you have any thoughts along that line?
Well, I don't. I had a number of people contact me during the election, actually, and they claim that some of these things connected with the EU are to do with satanic forces. And I must say, they make quite good cases. I mean, for instance, the EU building has been built to resemble Bruegel's picture of the Tower of Babel, and the statue outside shows Europa being raped by the bull and so on. I mean, there are some peculiar things, and the EU star symbols are supposed to be some sort of symbol of the devil. But I have my doubts about that. You may have some further insights into it, but it's not an area that I'm very expert in.
No, I don't know how to judge that. There are other people that talk about the occult organizations and many people that participate in that.
Yes, I've heard about this, but I've had no personal experience of it or reason to believe it one way or the other. I'm sorry.
I guess we could just account for it by the common greed that's going around and the lust for power.
There's certainly a lust for power, isn't there? Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, Fred. You know, it strikes me on that subject that that while there may be some real, I'm sure there's some real evil at the root of this, and I'm sure there's some real secrecies at the root of this, we can find the indicting circumstances just from their own paperwork and from their own political philosophy that they express. And once we understand that, there's nothing that we have to speculate about. You know, the goods are there. The globalist agenda needs to be rejected. We need to transition it out of America. We need, you know, you're working to transition it out of England, and that's that. And once it's all exposed, that evil rot will just crawl back into the woods where it belongs. We're going to welcome back some audiences here in just a few seconds, and I want to remind our audience that if you want to know more about sustainable development, go to our website, F21SC.net, and go to our store where you can find some handy tools. And welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. We're here for the last few minutes of our show tonight with Dr. David Abbott, having discussed the European Union and really the disintegration of Britain's legal and foreign policy and immigration authority over its own nation. These rules and edicts are now coming out of Brussels as part of the European Union. And in these last few minutes, David, what is it you'd like to leave with the audience in terms of understanding these dynamics and what people need to be aware of and what it is they can or should do?
Well, I think we need to hang on to democracy. I think we need to be extremely wary of any organization that we don't choose who governs us. I mean, that's a very basic thing for us Anglo-Saxons, as they call it, to be able to choose who governs us and how they govern us, and to be able to get rid of them if we don't like it. We've lost all that with these transnational organizations. I mean, the European Union is one of the worst, but there are others. They are all corrupt. They're following their own agenda. They're being run for the benefit of the elites that think them up. There are a number of websites which I'd like to possibly leave with your audience, Michael. You've mentioned the bruisegroup.com, and there's another one that I think is very good called tfa.net. That stands for the Freedom Association. And that is the leader of the Freedom Association is a man who was a Maastricht rebel. I talked to how they were all pressured to vote for the Maastricht Treaty. He was one of the few that held out against all the pressure that was being put on everybody at that time. It was a terrible time in the history of Britain, really. TFA.net. And my own one that's going to be coming up soon is BritsWorldwide.org. And the only bit that's up at the moment is my blog. So it's BritsWorldwide.org/blog. Anyway, I just sort of get that little add in. And there's also UKIP.org, UKIP.org. Those are all websites that deal in one way or another with the European Union.
Well, there's so much that Americans can learn about the true nature of the European Union, not what we hear on CNN and Fox News, but what the European Union really is doing to England. And
yes.
You've been a great insight for sharing that with us, as was Robert Theobald several months ago, who discussed some aspects of the European Union also. It is from learning from your experience that we can avoid getting ourselves as deep into this hot water as Brits have, and we want to work and coordinate with across both sides of the Atlantic to resurrect the ideals that were so well established and were fought so hard by Brits over so many centuries, and then by Americans, and all of that is, as we've said, is just slipping away as the idea of natural law is being overridden with legal positivism, rules, and the rules always benefit the rule makers and begin to squeeze down the liberties of each individual.
They do, and of course they're rewriting history as well. That's another way that they're able to do these kind of things, by rewriting history. They're constantly talking about reuniting Europe. Europe has never been united except under the Roman Empire.
Wow. Well, maybe that's their goal. I mean, we clearly know that the goal of the elites is to wrap us all up into one ball, and they've got plenty of money to buy their agents to go out and do that. And if you are involved in sustainable development programs, and that's where your income comes from, you know, you don't have to drop cold. You've got to just think through what you're doing and find a way to transition your own efforts. You know, if you're in schools, find a way to dig through and really present the history, not the history that the government textbooks are giving us and throwing down our children's throats. You know, we need to look at real documents and real history and get the real truth out, and that way this manipulated play isn't going to work. Doctor, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and just thank you very much.
Michael, thank you very much for having me. It was great.
Well, and tonight, that concludes our show for tonight, and we wish to look forward to you next week here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show.
So it's 59 even?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay. Well,